Morning, everybody. I'm relieved to see that the right presentation came up on the screen. That's always a good sign. My name is Margie Beaudry. My parents named me Margaret, but when you're Margaret, you know you're everything. You're Gretel and Peggy and Meg and Maggie, and eventually you have to pick something. So I picked Margie. The Public Health Foundation is a national organization there's my disclosure slide. Had to stick that in there. We're a national organization that focuses on using performance management, quality improvement, and workforce development to improve the quality and the performance of public health practice. So some of you may know us through the National Learning Management System known as TRAIN, which has 750,000 users and growing, 24,000 courses, most of which are free online for anybody who can get on the internet. We also staff the Council on Linkages Between Academia and Public Health Practice. And among other things, we have a robust set of services and resources and tools available related to building capacity for performance management and quality improvement in organizations such as public health departments, but certainly not limited to those. Our objectives for this 20 minutes firstly, to identify sources of evidence-based public health preventive interventions. Most folks are familiar here and there with a few places to go and look if they're looking for how do I tackle this particular problem. They know not to reinvent the wheel and they know where to look, but there really are a lot of comprehensive resources to look through, and we've created a compilation of what those are, and you'll see what I mean when I get further in. Secondly, to talk about and identify the decision factors that might impact the success of a public health intervention in your local community. So just because it's worked somewhere else doesn't mean it's going to work for you. Just because it made a difference somewhere and was the right choice for a particular community, even the community up the street, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work in your community. So what are the decision factors that come into play? And we'll be talking about those. And then learning a strategy for comparing these evidence-based interventions in order to get the best fit and therefore the greatest yield in your local context to actually make the biggest impact with the limited resources that you have. I want to give credit to Dr. Norma Kanarek, who is from Johns Hopkins. She worked with us a couple of years ago on a white paper, strategic practice selection exercises. That paper is available on the PHF website. It's a very academic approach to what I'm going to share with you, which I hope is a little bit more accessible for folks who might not need to call through all of the research in the very thorough way that she has done. The idea here is to tailor the exercise that she presents, which I will present, to your community so that you can weigh decision factors according to the local priorities that you have. And of course, you can substitute your own decision factors for those that are proposed here. These are meant to be examples. Many of them will be universal, but not all. The result that you get is a weighted ranking of potential interventions that are based on the applicability and the actual likelihood of success in your locale. And you can obviously use this approach to make decisions about programmatic directions, how you're going to invest your prevention resources to get the best results possible. So we heard a few minutes ago about the three requirements for getting started with accreditation, and those being the health assessment, the strategic planning for the health department, and the implementation planning. You can also imagine that these are the requirements for developing an intervention that's really going to be effective. First, you have to know what are our priorities, where do we want to focus. You have to have a plan for deciding how are we going to intervene, what's available to us, what's affordable, what's acceptable in our community, what's accessible to us, and how useful will those interventions be to address the problems that we identified in our assessment. And then, of course, implementation planning. How are we actually going to do this so that it will work effectively? We're going to focus on the second step during this presentation. So you already know what your problem is. Now it's time to decide what are we going to do about it and how do we make the choice to do that in the best possible way for our locale. So think global, act local. That's the theme of the overall meeting, and I wanted to bring that in here. I think it's very relevant. In terms of identifying potential interventions, the global part is you do want to look as far and wide as you can to understand all the good ideas and all the evidence-based practice that are already in play. You want to know what's cost-effective. You want to know what the potential, what's potentially applicable in your setting. It may or may not be your choice, but what really are the options for you? That's the global part. Next, we get to ranking those interventions and deciding what's going to really work for you. This is the local part. You need to assess the applicability and the likelihood of yielding results. And the factors that we're talking about are: how available is this to you? Can you afford it? Do you have the is it acceptable to your community? And what is the likely impact? So you may have a great intervention, but you may have difficulties with implementing that in your locale such that you may not actually be able to see the results come from it. So first, identify potential interventions. And this is probably not an exhaustive list, but a longer list than you may have seen in the past of different places you can go to look for evidence-based interventions. Don't worry about writing them down. At the end of this presentation, I don't think we managed to get the handouts into the room, but they should be available to you through the APHA meeting website. And if for some reason they're not, take my card. I'll be happy to send it to you. But at the end of the presentation, there are URLs for all of these resources, so don't feel you have to write them all down. Time will not allow me to go through them all in great detail, but I will talk a little bit more about three of them. We're going to talk about the Guide to Community Preventive Services, known as the Community Guide, the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices, and the National Prevention Strategy, which includes an appendix on justification for evidence-based recommendations. I'm not trying to endorse these three over the others. I simply had to choose only a couple to tell you about. And there is some redundancy, of course. Some of them cover the same things. So I'm identifying potential interventions. First, the Community Guide. Show of hands who've heard of this or familiar with it, may have used it? A couple of you. Okay. So this is a resource that allows you to choose programs and policies. So that's part of the intervention approach, could be a policy, to improve health outcomes. And there are 22 topic areas that include some of the usual suspects, tobacco, physical activity, and so forth. And there are more than 200 reviews on proven effectiveness, cost of interventions, return on investment, and that sort of thing. So it gives you a good starting place. The National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices covers more than almost 300 public health interventions for mental health and substance abuse specifically, and information to help determine which will best meet local needs. There aren't a lot of these repositories that are specific to a programmatic area, such as substance abuse and mental health, so this is one I wanted to underscore and call out. And then lastly, I'll just mention the National Prevention Strategy Appendix 5, evidence-based recommendations from five major scientific resources. And some of those resources are on the longer list. So this is a little bit of a sort of, it's like a Google search of these other evidence-based resources. You can sort of find it all in one place, at least not all of it, but you can find five of them all in one place rather than looking in five different spots. So that's a little teaser. That's a little bit of a flavor for all the different places that you can look to find interventions that may actually be appropriate for the problem you're trying to address and that has evidence behind it. Next step is, how do you decide what's going to work for you? Decision factors. So I want to introduce these factors. They're not the only ones that might be worth thinking about, but they seem to come up a lot in these conversations. So first, what is the strength of the evidence? So not all evidence-based programs are created equal. Some of the evidence may be more robust than others. Some of it may apply only to a particular age group or a population or a type of geographic area. So you want to take all that into account. How generalizable are these results and how strong are the data that you see? Organizational control. So do you have the leadership behind what you're trying to do? Do you have the infrastructure in your organization to pull this off, this particular intervention? What's the uptake? What's the additive penetration that you might get that reaching your high-risk groups, reaching your folks that you're trying to do prevention with? How likely is it that you're actually going to, with this intervention, reach those people? And that if it's a change in behavior, how likely is it that will actually be uptake of that change? Community acceptability. This is one we'll talk a little bit more about in a few minutes. This kind of ranges from how open the community is to a particular idea, to sort of how bruised are they from past efforts, what is the political climate that will or will not welcome a particular intervention. And then for some of these, we think about number of potential deaths averted. That isn't applicable in all cases, but when you think about motor vehicle accidents, when you think about tobacco, when you think about suicides, when you think about some of these things, measuring the number of deaths averted is a concrete way of suggesting maybe this is a decision factor for us. So we'll talk about an example. I'll show you in a moment how it plays out against the decision factors. In this example, the organization, in this case the health department, selected tobacco use as its public health priority. So they did their assessment, they decided tobacco use is where they wanted to invest their pennies. And then they went about finding potential evidence-based tobacco interventions. And in the rows, you'll see in a moment the table. So there are three rows in this table that show you sample interventions. Obviously, there are many more options, but these are the three they focused in on. The decision factors included the strength of the evidence as well as other variables that we've talked about related to the likelihood of success and the health impact potentially that could happen. So here's the example. You can see the decision factors across the top are the columns, number of deaths averted, the strength of the evidence, potential intervention delivery and coverage, community acceptability, organizational control. The rows are the public health interventions, and they, in this example, we have three. Increase the price of tobacco products. You think about community acceptability for that one for a minute. Limited youth access to tobacco. Avert exposures to second and third hand smoke. Obviously, this is not an exhaustive list of potential interventions for reducing tobacco use. But in this example, they focused in on these three. And the question becomes, all right, well, these are all potentially good approaches. What do we do from here? And you'll see the numbers in the cells. So what happened in this case is they did what's called a nominal group technique. This is a quality improvement tool. Being from the Public Health Foundation, I feel an obligation to always throw a quality improvement tool into everything that I present. And I say that only a little bit tongue-in-cheek. One of the things that we have found as we're working with organizations that are preparing for accreditation or just trying to solve a problem, whatever that problem may be, is that inevitably there are multiple quality improvement tools that can help make that work easier. So this is an example of an application of that. The nominal group technique essentially allows a group of people to sit around a table without doing a scientific study and simply weigh what is the strength of this particular intervention. In this case, we have three interventions, so the ranks are 1, 2, and 3. And in this case, it would be done by consensus. You could certainly do something more scientific. You could poll your whole health department. You could poll your potential target audience. There are lots of ways you could go about this. But the idea here is to end with a ranking of each intervention on each of the decision factors. So you can see, for example, that the potential number of deaths averted, limited youth access to tobacco gets a number one. That's the least impactful, okay? Avert exposure to secondhand and thirdhand smoke is the second least impactful. And the most impactful is increasing the price of tobacco products. But then when you look across to a community acceptability, you see it might not be so easy to do number three, to do the number of potential deaths averted through increasing prices of tobacco, because that one isn't as strong on community acceptability. So we rank each of these interventions on whatever decision factors we've chosen. And if you've got 10 interventions you're ranking, then there will be ranks of 1 to 10 in each of these columns. This is a forced ranking, so you have to break the ties. Nothing can be the same. You have to force through your conversation and through your assessment to figure out what really carries the day, which is the most weighty in terms of its likelihood of having a strong impact. And then you sum the rows across. So what you can see here is that limit youth access to tobacco wins by a nose. It gets one extra high ranking. And so in this case, in this very hypothetical example, they're going to go with limit youth access to tobacco. Now what I want to do is talk a little bit about the community acceptability. This is one, obviously, of the decision factors. For each of the decision factors, you could imagine going down this road and seeing all of the subfactors that are involved. So I want to take you through community acceptability and take a look at the subfactors, because for each of these decision factors, you could go through this exercise. But this is the one that is sometimes the diciest for people. So we're still in, is this going to work for us? limit youth access to tobacco had the highest overall ranking, therefore the greatest likelihood of successful impact. These are the sub-factors related to community acceptability. How applicable is it to health departments? So it's a great evidence-based intervention, but can we actually do it in our health department? Is it meant for health departments? Do we have utility for this? How reliable is the implementation? Is it going to be spotty? What's it going to cost us, obviously? How controversial is it? That's where we sort of start to tease apart the community acceptability piece. So in this case, the rating scale is 5 is the strongest and 1 is the weakest. That is somewhat arbitrary. You could make up your own scale. For this example, I've used a 1 to 5. So here we have, on this table, the acceptability components are down the left-hand side, just the ones that I just introduced you to, and across the top is the rating scale. So you can see, and I don't know how easy it is to read, but for example, if you look at potential controversy potential, the second to the bottom row, it would get a 5 if it addresses the protection of the whole population. Not very controversial. It helps everybody. Nobody loses. On the far end of the spectrum at number 1, this may address illegal activity, right? If this were substance abuse, maybe this is a needle exchange program. This is an unfavored subpopulation. Maybe this is folks that we don't particularly enjoy helping because they seem to take a lot out of the community. Or has negative impacts as well. There may be a balance to be struck. So an intervention is going to get a 1 on this if it is more controversial. It's going to get a 5 if it's sort of a no-brainer, you know, who could object to it. And you can see that for some of these, there are more nuanced rankings that you could identify, depending on the acceptability component that you've chosen and depending on sort of the layers of gradation that you perceive in your community, you could define very different levels. So you could, for instance, on applicability to the health department, the first component, a 5 would be that it's consistent and consonant with the agency's mission and traditional roles, so fits right in with what we already do. And then as you move to the right, it might be similar to interventions and populations that we work with, not identical, but we could make it work. The consensus is that it's worthwhile. This is number 3, but the community isn't so sure, not so keen about it. The public health community within our organization or perhaps beyond. As we move to the right, now there's a genuine difference of opinion about whether the agency should have a role in that intervention. And then finally, maybe it's seen as peculiar or strange or not helpful to the community or the whole population. So you have to assess that component, and individuals may be using that assessment as they're arriving at their own ranking. When you think about the first table that we saw, the group is thinking about all of these factors as they're saying, well, is this a 1 or a 2 or a 3? Oops, I think I went too far, too fast. Maybe I didn't. I'm all right. So as I mentioned to you before, at the back of the document, here are all of the website addresses for all of those evidence-based resources that I mentioned. I really commend them to you. There is some redundancy across them, but one of the most frustrating things is not knowing where to begin to find an intervention that might be applicable in your organization. This goes on for another page. And then obviously a link to the practice selection exercise paper from Dr. Kennerick on which this is based. Take a breath and see if anyone has any questions. Who are the key stakeholders? Are you asking who are the people at the table doing the ranking? That's a very specific decision that's going to be based on a lot having to do with the history in your organization. So, if you think about an intervention that may be on the more controversial side. Or a problem that may be on the controversial side or very widespread, you have to think very carefully about who's making those choices because you're going to have to defend those choices to folks who may not think it's worth investing in an intervention there. You want to have people who are knowledgeable about the problem. And if you're concerned about community acceptability, then you probably need to have folks from the local community as well there. I don't think there's a magic formula there. I think what you want to avoid is sort of having all the usual suspects around the table, partly because you want new perspectives and partly because you want, once you've made your choices, you want to have engagement in that and support for that across the board. You absolutely could, and I've certainly seen it done that way. You also could do a much more elaborate prioritization exercise using a prioritization matrix, where you can get lots more votes, and you can crunch the numbers and have it be completely anonymous. So the do it around the table and have a discussion approach is certainly one, and that isn't going to work for every organization. There are organizations where every vote doesn't count equally, and probably shouldn't. And so it's hard to say whether the anonymous sort of democratic approach is the right approach, but it certainly can be done that way, and there are organizations that feel much more comfortable without having to sort of put a name and a face with a point of view. I've seen folks use sort of a focus group approach to get a feel for the acceptability of an intervention in a community or whether they would really penetrate the community that they're trying to target. I've certainly seen that. I haven't so much seen the target population as part of the ranking process. It's more of a programmatic decision, and I don't know how comfortable a health department, for instance, would be with that, but certainly in terms of getting a feel for whether an intervention would be welcomed by the community, absolutely getting that input is helpful. Well, I think, in my experience, there's a lot of status quo that happens, not just in public health, certainly, but it happens in public health where we have folks who've been in the organization for a very long time. They do things the way they do things. They've always done it that way. It's not broken, don't fix it. And it can be very hard to make change happen. I'm struck by the commonality of the transformation theme that sort of comes up here, creating an environment where change is not only acceptable but attractive for folks and not threatening. It can be very difficult. So certainly that's one of the barriers, is if you're introducing an intervention that hasn't been tried in a location before and challenges people's assumptions, then you have to educate people about the evidence, and you have to have enough trust and enough credibility to encourage people to take a risk. I think another barrier can be cost, depending on what the intervention is. Sometimes cost is a little bit of a red herring barrier. Everybody rushes to cost as the reason we can't do whatever it is, and often that's legitimate, there also are ways of offsetting costs and of finding economies of scale that can make something that looks on the face of it to be out of your reach to make it more accessible. And sometimes you can use parts of a program rather than a whole program and save costs that way, or save expenses that way. I think that there is... I see less of this now, but I think that historically there's actually been some resistance to a more analytical approach to making choices. We're in service professions. We care about the public health. We're here because of our heart as well as our heads, and a lot of times we want to make heart-based decisions. And these decisions, particularly if they're done anonymously and through some sort of survey or sort of a ballot process, is a very quantitative decision-making process. I mean, it doesn't appeal to a lot of folks in public health. They want to talk it through, which is why the doing it around the table is appealing in many respects. So I think one of the barriers is people believing the numbers that they generate as a group and being willing to go with it. I mean, I think the other piece of this is it comes back to quality improvement and having a plan, do, check, act orientation to whatever you do. So anytime you bring in a new approach, a new intervention that you haven't tried in your location before, you have to adapt it. You have to figure out what's going to really make it work. And you're going to plan for it. Then you're going to try it. You're going to do it. Then you're going to check and see if it's working. And if it's not working to the degree that you had hoped it would or that you anticipated it would, then you have to go back and see, well, how are we not penetrating the right population, or how are we where is this not succeeding where we thought it would? And that's where the quality improvement piece comes back in. And there are lots of other tools there to help you. But so I think part of it is a willingness to try and see and know that it may not work the first time out.
Thank you.
My pleasure.